views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to a wet Sunday afternoon in the San Francisco Bay Area, home of the Space Show, and I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in, and hopefully it's dry wherever you are. And we have a great show today because one of our favorite guests, Dr. Plata, goes to Washington, and you're going to hear all about that. But first, a couple of announcements. Our phone number, if you do want to talk to Dr. Doug, is 1-866-687-7223. So do remember, there are no call screeners, and be patient and let the phone ring, and I will bring you up on air as quickly as possible. There's only one toll-free line, so if it's busy, please be patient. And if your patience gets exhausted, email me and tell me that you're waiting, and I'll manage to keep you on a few more minutes while I get rid of the caller that is taking up the line. But again, it is 1-866-687-7223. You can also reach us by email, drspace@thespaceshow.com, and by the Space Show blog, which is on our website, thespaceshow.com. Go over to the far right to upcoming shows. You'll see Dr. Plata's show listed. Open it up. Scroll all the way down to comments. Post your question or comment for Doug, and I will be able to read that on the air. Also on the spaceshow.com site, the new newsletter for the week will be uploaded after the show ends today. So make sure you scroll down on that newsletter because it shows you what's planned for the Space Show over the next several weeks, actually through the end of the year as we're booking shows into November and December. Everything we do is archived, and you can easily download these programs or play them on air just off of the website. We have a store. Check out the menu in the upper left part of the website. If you're interested in Space Show gear, T-shirts, coffee mugs, that type of thing, you do that under the support menu up at the top. There's also listen live instructions and other links and items that may interest you. And then, as I said, there is the menu on the far right with recent shows, upcoming shows, which I've already explained to you, and they're already there for the coming week, and then listener voices, and you can hear what different Space Show listeners want you to know about. And Dr. Doug has a couple of messages there, so do check that out. And then do remember that we're copyrighted and trademarked, and you are free to download our programs or share them or send the URLs around. The rules in doing this are not to do anything commercial with the program. Don't make any edits and put edits up on YouTube or any other website. And then written transcripts are not permitted even for your own personal use. Podcasting is done through gigadial.net with Andrew Grummet. When we thank them for this service, we're in iTunes and other places on the net. If you have any podcasting questions, do let us hear from you. And the best way to get a hold of me is through email, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And a word about sponsors. I am happy to say, and I'm really not trying yet because there's a couple of months left before the end of the year, but AIAA has renewed their sponsorship for 2017, and we have a new sponsor. The Space Foundation will be with us starting in November of this year. The first segment of today's program is brought to you by the AIAA. This is the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. It is the world's largest aerospace pro society. They have over 30,000 individual members, such as myself and others. 88 countries are represented, 95 corporate members, and they're busy shaping the future of aerospace every day. They advance the state of aerospace science and technology and increase the knowledge of the universe, bringing worlds closer together. Check them out at their website, AIAA.org. Become a member. You don't have to be an engineer to become a member. And a great organization with a terrific meeting. And Orbital ATK is a sponsor. They're the global leader in aerospace and defense technology. They are known as the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. And our guest, as I said a few minutes ago, is Dr. Doug Plata, and Doug is a physician and public health specialist out of Loma Linda, California. His undergraduate degree was in biophysics, and he went on to complete his MD and MPH with specialty training in family and preventative medicine. His involvement in space has only emerged over the past several years. His primary interest in space is the development of a cislunar transport system and infrastructure using lunar polar ice for propellant. A description of his concept is at cislunar1.com. And he also established the online Lunar COTS petition, which has attracted signatures of individuals from NASA, industry, academia, advocacy organizations, and space journalists. If you haven't signed it, you should check it out and sign it. It's worthwhile. Doug, welcome back. How are you?
Doing well. Thank you, David. Good to be back on the show.
So you went to Washington. You're a seasoned lobbyist. And did they blow you off? Did they bow at your feet for going to the moon? What did you go to lobby for? What was your subject matter?
Well, it was overall a generally good experience, actually. And I went to lobby for the particular things that I feel from a policy standpoint, especially as we transition to a new administration, the directions that I like to see. And the key thing there is the lunar cost, the public-private program for lunar return, as well as development of a lunar lander, a cryogenic reusable lunar lander, sort of a Mast and Zeus type of lander as a critical technology. Other topics came up, but those were sort of my two things that I was really trying to pitch.
And how did you pick your members of Congress to go talk to?
Yeah, so I visited my local congressman, Representative Takano. Now, he's on the Space Committee, on the Science Committee, but not on the Space Subcommittee. But I figured, you know, I might as well visit my own representative while I'm there, or at least his office. But then, basically, I got a list of those representatives who are on the Space Subcommittee, and regardless of where they're coming from. And so I emailed, I found out who their space staffers were, and then I emailed them and requested an appointment, and I gave them a 3-day range that I would be able to do that, and got the replies to do that.
Did everyone reply and make an appointment for you?
Not all, but I was pleased. It seemed like it's about, I don't have the numbers, but I'm going to say probably about 70% of those people that I emailed to replied, and it was, you know, it wasn't, what is this about? It's like, okay, these are the days that you can, you know, that we, you know, that they have available. And so basically all of those that replied, I got appointments with. So I was fairly pleased at the response. Those that did not respond, I could have, as is sort of my tradition, I could have gone and after, you know, 3 or 4 days, gone and sent another email, just a reminder that, you know, because oftentimes we receive emails and intend to respond, but we don't have time at that moment. And so it just takes a little reminder. But frankly, as many appointments as I was getting, I felt like I was running out of time in terms of, like, you know, the appointment schedule. So I didn't actually follow up on those that didn't reply. I think there was 4 of them that didn't reply.
How much time did you have with each staffer?
So this worked out very well. I intentionally schedule it on an hourly basis, on the half hours, like, you know, 11:30 and 12:30 and 1:30 appointments. And that worked out very well because I wasn't able to entirely control how much time I would spend with each of the space staffers. And so to do it in increments of hour intervals worked out perfectly because I was able to, you know, if it was my conversation was a little more extended, like beyond a half an hour, that would still provide me with enough time to figure out where the next appointment's office was. So it worked out very well.
And so what did you do? You opened up after saying hello and all of that with a pitch on what you're there for? Or tell us how it went.
Yeah, so fortunately I had a little bit of experience the year before when I went to the Mars Society convention, and I arranged for two appointments of two representatives at that time. So I already sort of got a feel. I felt, you know, first-time anxiety last year that I did it, but this year when I came in, sort of had an idea about how it'd work out. So you have to understand that the staffers, I think, are, like, trained, and they're expected to treat people who come to the representative's office, to treat them with a great deal of, you know, respect and appreciation, and really make the visit a very positive thing. I did not feel that I was getting the brush off or anything like that. It seems as though that they take copious notes. In general, they take copious notes, and they ask questions to understand what you're trying to say, you know, what you're trying to ask for or whatnot. And so my sense, I mean, they each had almost like the same type of notepad, and they were, you know, sort of a ring spiral bounder, and as you're talking, they're taking notes, copious notes. And my impression was is that they would write up some sort of report to the representative, just a summary of what was discussed. They probably have those records on file in case there's ever any future conversation. So we would meet, come in the office. I would arrive just right at my appointment time, and the front office would go ahead and go into a back room and get the person that I was there with an appointment with, and then we would meet and just have some very basic pleasantries, and then it's a question of where we were going to meet, whether in the office or several times it was actually out in the hallway. And then basically the staffer, the question was, okay, what did you wanted to talk about? And then it was my ball game, basically.
So how did it go? Do you want to tell us who you went to see or be more general, or how do you want to share your experiences with us?
Yeah. So David, as I spoke with you before, I'm going to tell you exactly who I met, and I'm going to give you, you know, I'm not sure whether these were sort of confidential conversations or whatnot, but I'm going to sort of tell you, like, who said positive things. There was some negative experiences in that I felt like I didn't really achieve my objective with certain people, but I don't want to reflect negatively on individuals because I want to maintain those relationships, and some things may have been said with an expectation of confidentiality, so I'll sort of say what was said, but I won't attribute it to the person who said it. So here's my score sheet. So I actually visited with eight of the space staffers, which was like probably the majority of the representatives on the space subcommittee. And by my qualitative assessment, two of those staffers, I would say, were rather lacking in knowledge about anything in regards to space. And by and large, the reason for that was because they were sort of new to their position, their handling. You know, these people are not technologically, you know, not scientifically trained. They are, you know, like your history, political science type people. Some of them were fairly young, fairly new to the job, and they were having to handle, you know, energy as well as, you know, other technology as well as space. So I was not necessarily meeting with space advocates or people who really knew much about space at all. So two of them were pretty, you know, where I had to explain, you know, what's up with space. One of them was actually a surprisingly pretty negative sort of interaction, which I'll explain. One of them was a somewhat negative, I think more because of his personality. Two of them, I would say, were positive. Ended up, you know, sort of in a positive sort of feel. And then two of them were very, very positive to where, you know, yeah, I'll tell you about those as well, but very positive. So It was really across the board. I mean, I had all sorts of a wide variety of experiences, and I mean, I went for 6 hours of lobbying, one appointment after another. So it was really intense, and it was a bit of an emotional roller coaster for me because I was going into these situations not really knowing how it would go, whether it would go positive or negative. Some went positive, some went negative, some were neutral, and it was just one after another, so I was like on this, you know, bucking bronco going for a ride, and it was a pretty real and pretty wild sort of experience, which I very, very glad that I did.
Okay, so without naming names then, let me ask you this. How knowledgeable about space and the specific topics in space that you wanted to talk about were the staffers, and could you tell any difference between staffers that were Republican or Democrat or Congress versus Senate?
Well, I didn't meet with any of the Senate staffers. I just sort of focused on the representatives. Now, next time I think I want to go ahead and try the Senate. That might be a different experience because they really have, they're covering much larger population. So I don't know if I'm going to get much time with them or whatnot, or exactly how that'll go. So it's just the representatives, just that space, you know, that's science, space and technology sub our committee of the as representatives. Basically, my general take is the younger the representative, the less they knew about space. The ones who's had been the space staffer or a representative that had been there for a long time were very knowledgeable about space. So as a general rule, basically the length at which the representative was on the committee correlates, I think, with the how much knowledge their space staffer had. I think that just sort of makes sense.
When you say age, you're not talking about their chronological age, but how long they've been in the House.
In particular, how long they've been on that committee.
On that committee, okay.
In other words, it's sort of like it takes a while to gain experience, including for your staffers to, you know, if you've been around the block a few years, you know, the staffers are dealing with different issues that come up, and they educate themselves, and over time they become better and better space staffers, more knowledgeable, as well as the representatives. I don't know, but I presume.
Okay. To your specific topics, were they knowledgeable or interested? Did the interest seem real or phony or for your specific issues?
I would say, with the exception of one guy, sort of a cynical staffer, I would say most all of them seemed very interested. And to a fair degree, it's interested because it's their job to be interested, and it's their job to go ahead and find out what is your message, because it's their job to go ahead and pass that message on. So really no problem with interest, I think. And frankly, I don't know, David, how much time do you think I would typically get with a space staffer?
Well, I can tell you that when I used to do it with AIAA in Washington, D.C., and also in California with the old California organization that went under, we scheduled about 15 minutes, and some of them we were in and out in 10 minutes after waiting 15 minutes, and others went for 45 minutes because the staffers were, in a couple of instances, the representative himself or herself took the meeting and was incredibly interested and kept us there with a lot of questions. So I would say on average we were probably with a staffer around 15 minutes.
So when I was with the staffers, it ranged between like 25 to 35 minutes, which surprised me. That they would give me so much time. I planned, or I tried, I don't know, a year and a half ago to go with the March storm.
Uh-huh.
But then I broke my wrist and thumb in a motorcycle accident, so I really couldn't go. Really severely sprained my ankle too, so I would have been on crutches and hard with, you know, with my wrist being the way it is. So I canceled that, but I sort of learned a little bit about, you know, what's involved. I think I watched a March Storm video on YouTube in which they're describing it. And my sense is the professional way of doing lobbying is you are sort of well-trained, you know, you're a lobbyist, sort of well-trained, and you go in and you have a paper deliverable and you have your key, you know, your key messages, and you stick to message, and you deliver your message, and you deliver the paper, and you're sort of done, and you gotta, you know, be very concise about the message because you're going to get precious little time. If you want to be the most effective with a little amount of time. My experience as a personal lobbyist was different in that I was sort of in my own mind trying to wrap things up because I want to be respectful of their time, but they seemed pretty, you know, pretty open. They, if I had more to say, they wanted to hear and listen and understand. So my experience was different in a positive sort of way compared with what I was expecting.
So what'd you come out of it with? I mean, give us some specifics. Did they kind of blow you off? Do they make promises that they can or can't compete? Do they raise objections like, God, we have so many financial problems or this, that, and the other? What happens when you lay this out for them?
Yeah, again, it was all over the board. It was, maybe I can just begin to mention some specific situations to sort of describe. Let me sort of start with the positive, and I'll work towards the negative. One fellow was not a space staffer, was not really very knowledgeable. And yet his, in my interaction with him, I sort of start out my interaction by saying, you know, I know different staffers have different knowledge, you know, levels of knowledge about space. Can I ask you what your knowledge is so I can tailor what I say to that? And they didn't have a problem with that. They flat out told me whether they, you know, they knew quite a bit or moderate or very little. They're very, even the ones with very little, they're very straightforward and honest about that. Didn't seem to have a problem with my asking. Well, this one guy was my last appointment, and he said flatly, I really don't know hardly anything about it. So I went into sort of educational mode with him, so that was ended up being a positive, but because he was starting almost from scratch. You know, I don't know what became of that because he's sort of being a bit overwhelmed by new information that he doesn't know anything about. Another one that turned out very positive, he was very attentive, a staffer from Texas, very attentive to me and was taking notes, like they most all did. And then as I was speaking with him, yeah, you know, you're reading the person, so I was getting very positive vibes from him. And at the end, he said, I sort of turned the tables a little bit, and I said, look, this is my first time lobbying, and so, you know, I'm not quite sure how to go from what I'm proposing, the lunar costs, you know, the public-private programs, to where it becomes a bill. And then the tables turned, and he started educating me about that process, and he ended up by saying that, you know what, my representative, you know, he needs to be introducing bills, and so let's be in touch and let's go ahead and work on this. And he said that there, I'm embarrassed to say I didn't know this, but there is the Office of Legislative Counsel, I think it is, and what this is like an office filled with lawyers, and their job is to help the representatives write law according to the right way that you write it, the correct way that you write it. And so if somebody like myself working with a staffer sort of begin to craft what should be within the bill and then working with the representative to make sure it represents the representative's view, and then once we have an idea, then it's taken to that Office of Legislative Counsel and they actually start crafting the bill and then the bill is submitted, you know, starting with the committee and then working into the floor. And frankly, I didn't know that was the process. But here's a guy who's saying, hey, let's be in touch, let's work together, and let's see if we can go ahead and turn this into a bill. I'm like, wow, that's that was like my best interaction there. Another one, and I'll mention who this is. This is Christopher Ingraham with he's a space staffer for Bridenstine. Now, as you know, and as many of the listeners know, Representative Bridenstine is, in my opinion, one of the leading representatives on the Space Subcommittee, because he has developed the Space Renaissance Act, the American Space Renaissance Act, and this is a rather comprehensive, multifaceted space bill that deals with, you know, most every aspect of space that, that the government is involved with. And so he's put this out, and the thought is that this would provide, you know, these pieces as part of the act, that the individual pieces could turn into individual bills and possibly be considered and passed one by one. And so as I was speaking with Mr. Ingraham, he, as I was describing my approach, and basically I have these four principles to how I, you know, judge space policy or craft or propose space policy, as I went through those principles, the space staffer says, you know what, I think that you and Mr. Bridenstine are very well aligned. And for the space staffer for Bridenstine to say that, to me was very flattering, and I was very, very pleased to hear that and felt like that that was a good connection.
Does that mean you're moving to Tulsa?
No, although I'm sure you think that would be cool.
No, I left, although there are parts of it that I very, very seriously miss. But, you'd like it's a great place to live and have a family.
I bet. I interviewed there for a family medicine residency and had a good experience there. So,
well,
let me tell you, this is a bit of a surprise because, you know, Michael Listener had done a show
on the American Space Renaissance. Yeah, and he's talked about it quite a bit on the air and in his newsletter.
And he's written two or maybe three articles in the Space Review about it. But that was a while back. So I had this, you know, half an hour break before I met with Bridenstine's space staffer. And so I said, oh, man, I better quick look on the Internet and sort of refresh my memory about what all is in that bill. So I did a quick refresh so I wouldn't be ignorant, you know. And so when I met, I knew that there was one issue that I felt might be a bit of a sticker between my views and the views of Mr. Bridenstine. And that is this issue of, which is an important popular issue, I think, and that is the feeling that if we keep switching directions in American space policy, that we're going to get nowhere. And so let's set a direction and let's stick with that direction by having a administrator for NASA that's appointed for 10 years at a time, by funding programs over not just a year-by-year basis. And there's a third thing. It's just, you know, just like the program, let's just not change the program. Well, I've got a bit of an issue with that, and that is, that works great if you have a program that is worth sticking with. But one of my four principles is that the programs ought to be as cost-effective as possible. And so if we have a set of programs that are not anywhere close to being the most cost-effective, then do you really want to stick with a cost-ineffective program over a long period of time without considering alternate programs? You know, it's sort of like Pulse Buddhist, in one of his articles, he quoted C.S. Lewis, basically saying, if you're headed down the wrong road, the progressive is the one that turns around the earliest. And I think that there can be times in space policy in which the best thing we can do is turn around, you know, and head back or choose a different direction. The longer we go, the more money we might be throwing down a hole, you know. So I was a bit, you know, concerned about saying this to Bridenstine's staffer, because that's like an important part of the Space Renaissance Act. But I was very, very pleased that when I mentioned that, the space staffer did say that it did make sense that, you know, we want to make sure that the programs are cost effective. I think that's the principle that Bridenstine supports. And so the staffer ended up saying, you know, I think you guys are actually very close in your views on things. So I sort of, you know, blew a sigh of relief when I heard him say that. So there was the other two that were positive, not extremely positive, but pretty positive, were staffers from a representative in Florida as well as one in Colorado. And basically they were very attentive, taking notes, made positive comments. And so I ended up with sort of a good feel, but I wouldn't say any sort of breakthrough. It was interesting, the one from Colorado, I'm sorry, if I get these mixed up.
Were they, by the way, men or women? Did it make any difference?
No, there was two women and the other were men. The women were not knowledgeable, were not terribly knowledgeable about space, but I think that's coincidence more than a pattern, because there's only two of them, and one of them was actually the space staffer for my representative, but he's not on the space subcommittee, so I'm not surprised that she didn't know space all that well. Another one from Colorado, Democrat, was after I went through and explained, and they're very, you know, taking notes, very attentive. When I got done, the gal, she says, I should let you know that Mr. Perlmutter is more of a, make sure if I get this right, I don't want to misrepresent. I think I'm a little confused on who said this. I won't attribute it. But when I got done saying that the representative was more, she said she was, he was more of a traditionalist in terms of space policy. So with a focus on Mars and basically continuing the current program, like Obama's program. And she, it was clear to me that she felt as though I was suggesting a different path than that. And I can understand why she said that. But the point that I was trying to make was that a low-cost lunar program is, I believe, compatible to a fair degree with the current program of record, which is, do we have a name for the current program of record?
If there is, I can't think of it, or I don't know it, but maybe a listener will tell us. But usually they just talk about the program of record. But I guess the program of record includes SLS Orion, the NASA Mars Roadmap around the 2030 period, give or take, and the Asteroid Redirect mission, because officially the Moon is not on the program of record, nor is cislunar development, as far as I know. So if there are traditionalists supporting the program of record, they would be supporting SLS Orion, this Mars Roadmap idea of the 2030s,
yeah,
and the Asteroid Redirect mission is still part of the program.
So I'm going to call the program of record the Journey to Mars, which includes SLS Orion and Steps Towards Mars, as we understand it currently. And so she was very, I think she sort of was basically messaging back to me that, you know what, I hear what you say, but do realize that he is more aiming towards, you know, the Journey to Mars. And I said, you know, I felt like maybe I hadn't made myself clear. So even though she needed to go on to another meeting, I did clarify with her. I said, you know what, the lunar cost program is done with a public-private approach, no more than probably 5% of NASA's budget to do that, the lunar cost approach. I believe that that is compatible with a continued journey to Mars. I was a little concerned that maybe I didn't clarify that, you know, before she had her statements at the end. But still, overall, it was, I think, a positive meeting. So there were two that were not knowledgeable. And so I went into my educate mode, including a little broader than what I came to talk about, just because I think they needed to know some things. Last year, when I spoke with a fellow who wasn't knowledgeable, he didn't even know that we were purchasing flights by, from the Russians to send their people to the International Space Station. I mean, that was how little knowledge he had at that time. I met with him again. He knows more now, you know, a year later. But and then finally was the negative meeting. So one of them was a fella who just basically had a cynical attitude, I would say. So I got the most time with him, but he had, you know, cynical questions about, well, why should we even care about going to the moon? He said, you know, is, you know, I was thinking, well, he was with a Republican, so I tried the space leadership approach, including concern about China. If China, I believe, could take the lead if we continue to neglect the moon. If they pursue the moon, they could establish the first off-Earth permanent base, which could be the beginning of big things in space, you know, like heading towards settlement. So historically could be significant. His comment was, so are you saying that it's just to beat the Chinese, you know, just sort of like who's the better country? And I'm like, you know, goodness. So fortunately, the more I spoke with them, the more things turned around. So we ended up on a sort of a neutral, maybe a little bit positive sort of view. But my sense was I think I'd rather speak with the representative directly, because I suspect, as I've seen him on C-SPAN, he's a very smart guy, and I think perhaps could understand the perspective that I have. Now, the final one, this is the most interesting, but, boy, I came away sort of felt a little spanked by the meeting. And it was, of all things, Rohrabacher's staffer. So I was given a good amount of time, and he was very attentive, and he was totally engaged in the conversation, total back and forth sort of thing. But what it was, this really, I didn't have a good answer to him, but while I was sharing about my views, he basically came to the point. He says, look, we are in a phase in which we are not going to be expanding budgets. So whatever you describe in terms of returning to the moon, that money had to be taken from other programs. So the program of record is the journey to Mars. So how does this speed up or lower the cost for going to Mars? Okay?
Okay.
It's a tough question. Okay, in other words, any money that you take away from other programs, including maybe the Mars program, you know, within NASA, however that money is spent, will have to speed up the journey to Mars, okay? And I consider that a tall order. What I did was probably a big mistake. If I had it to do over again, I think I would use a very different strategy. But I myself, based on calculations that I've done, I do not believe that the production of propellant from the moon would reduce cost of going to Mars. I think it's far cheaper to use the cheapest way of delivering propellant from Earth to an EML staging point than it would be to spend the money to develop a lunar base and then produce propellant. And I mean, no matter what price you put on the development of the base, Buddhist is $87 billion, Charles Miller $50 billion, or my $15.2 billion. Either way you slice it, you can still deliver it cheaper using Falcon Heavy, partially reusable, and especially if you use ion propulsion from low Earth orbit to an EML staging point for not crew, but for cargo and propellant including. The numbers don't even come close. When I did those calculations, found out that was the story, I myself changed in my mind, in my argument, that I thought that based on orbital mechanics, it would cost less to deliver propellant from the moon to an EML staging point. After I ran the numbers, I said, you know what, I don't believe that anymore. And so when I was speaking with Rohrabacher's staffer, I explained, point out, I don't believe, I mean, the logical thing, how does going to the moon reduce the cost of going to Mars? The quick response would be, well, if we produce propellant, that could reduce the number of launches of SLSs, and look at all that would be saved. But I told the staffer that I said, you know, I don't believe that, and I explained the reason why. And he says, okay, so how does going to the moon reduce the cost of going to Mars? And I'm like, oh, boy. I hadn't really thought about that. Because I consider the moon a legitimate destination in its own right and has a lot of benefits to going to the moon. So for the sake of the moon, we should go to the moon. That's my perspective. Now he's telling me I've got to work within the restraints, the constraints, of how does this reduce cost going to Mars. And so I sort of hemmed and hawed and tried different things, and I realized it wasn't working and time was passing. And so we basically ended up concluding the meeting, and I didn't feel like I had given him a satisfactory answer, you know. And I'm like, oh, man, Rohrabacher's like the most, you know, he is the space advocate on the House side. I mean, of all representatives, I would consider. And here I couldn't believe that, you know, I was struggling in that meeting. And then it was days later that I was continuing to think about this. I'm like, oh, man, I could mention this and I could mention that. And I wrote up like 12 different reasons. But a lot of them were, well, how can you reduce the cost of going to the moon, but not that doesn't necessarily reduce the cost of going to Mars. And so as it stands right now, the thing that I can think of that I can honestly say would reduce the cost of going to Mars would be that if we were to figure out how to extend crew stay on the moon, then that could be applied to Mars. And I think it would be better for us to learn how to do that on the moon where we have a quick, safe return, rather than trying to do it from the get-go on Mars. And so if we can extend crew stay on Mars, yes, that could go ahead and significantly not only reduce cost, but also reduce risk to crew, because there'd be less launching, EDL, ascent and reentry, events as we extend crew stay. So, I need to go ahead and follow back with him and be able to say, hey, I don't think I had a clear answer for you at the time, but here's my thinking now, and then see if that makes any difference.
I did a show not too long ago, and I think the guest I want to remember here is Casey Dreyer, but I'm not 100% sure. Did you hear Casey's interview?
Yeah, I did.
So you can tell me if I'm wrong or not, but Casey, or the guest that I'm not remembering, made the point when we were talking about SLS and Orion that the politics behind a mission often drive the mission, and there would be no mission were it not for the political angle. So the economics of the mission or the technology being used or the science, they only account for so much of a mission. But Congress, as a political body, also needs to have a political reason. So, for example, the Europa mission partially exists because the politics are they'll use SLS, which Congress is continuing to commit to using. So without that commitment to use SLS, there's no political will to go to Europa, even though there may be science or technical will. So when you talk to these people, so to me, the one that's the most realistic is this guy from Rohrabacher's office, because he says, this is what Congress has done. This is what our official goal is. This is what we've told NASA their official goal is. So how do you support that goal? So that's the political part of NASA saying this mission is only going to happen if A, B, and C happen. And by the way, yeah, we do need the right technology, and we do want to make it as economic as possible. But without the politics here, it's not going to happen at all. And that's really what he was asking you. And I think as I talked to, again, if it was Casey, I said that political aspect of the mission is overlooked by almost all space advocates and people that come on the space show, because they wage the argument in terms of technology and economics, and they're missing the political needs of Congress for a mission. I think it was Casey who made these comments, and that was an eye-opener for me.
It certainly was Casey. And yeah, I was frankly fairly distressed when I was listening to that program, because what it's basically saying is we're going to waste taxpayer dollars for potentially decades pursuing something that that may not end up being used in the final analysis, but because the political optics are what they are, then the only way to be able to do anything is to waste a lot of money over a lot of period of time. And
But it's not apparently it's not a waste to them, because that extra money is giving them the political side of this mission or that mission. So I guess they don't consider that in terms of waste.
They being who?
Congress.
Well, I mean, then there's no such thing as actually pork, but there is.
Well, there's pork to the rest of us. I don't
believe in the truth. I believe in objectivity.
I mean, if Casey is correct and their mission needs this maybe 30% component of politics behind it, or it doesn't happen, then obviously every single mission or thing that that Congress doesn't have to be related to space, is going to contain pork in it. And as you see, what does Congress do that doesn't have pork in it?
So, I mean, my perspective is that I want to be on the side of fighting against pork. There may be a practical aspect of it where you, like, say, for example, when I sort of came to terms myself with the SLS, I was sort of like, well, if we can get the cost of developing a lunar base using commercial launchers, I mean, this is just a repeat of what we did with COPS, commercial cargo and commercial crew. So just, we did it there, we were able to do it, so let's just do the same thing for the moon. And when I took a look at the numbers, it looked like we really could do it for about 5 to 7% of NASA's budget. And I said, at that low amount, I think that it could still be compatible with SLS and Orion, et cetera. But we would need to increase NASA's budget by that modest amount, or we need to, you know, find little ways here and there to go ahead and reduce the cost otherwise, to open up some budgetary space. I mean, the Casey Dreyer's presentation, I mean, it sounds like, you know, let's give up the fight against wastage, and let's just try to join in with it and be able to achieve our goals in the context of that wastage. And I think that I got a problem with that.
Well,
I truly do.
Again, I don't think they see this as wastage, and so. I think that, you know, there's obvious, and you have a caller on hold, by the way, and an email waiting. But my hunch is that Casey, as much as you and I might not like to know that that is how Congress functions, how about that for grammar? But that is a reality, and they don't see pork and waste the way you and I and many others may see it, and again, I'm not limiting this just to space, but into, I'm assuming this is spread throughout the way Congress carries out business. And I think that this is part of why Americans, the vast majority of Americans, think Congress really sucks, because they see all this waste, and some of it may be corruption, some of it may not be. Space is just a tiny bit of it. Remember that, you know, it's 0.5% of the whole total budget. And we know it is waste, but apparently, again, going by what Casey said, Congress views waste differently, and they require what we call waste to fund, you know, to make a mission happen, which means they got to reward and satisfy many different members of Congress and many different districts across many different regions and states. And I have no clue how you can overcome that, but, you know, the guys say, I'm not going to fund that unless you throw some of that my way and this, that, and the other. And for them, I'd love to see their indoctrination class when a new member of Congress, you know, get sworn in and they're introducing them into how everything works in Congress. Wouldn't you just love how to hear how they describe, you know, waste and pork? Because no matter who gets elected and no matter how they run on a platform to get rid of pork, does anyone get rid of pork? No. They succumb to doing these deals and passing, you know, legislation and stuff that have some kind of this what we call inefficient system as part of the system. So I wonder if it's in their manuals. I have no clue. But
I have a different view. I know we have a caller which we should get to, but I have a less cynical view, which came out from these meetings. But maybe we could take the caller.
Just hold on to your view, okay?
Okay.
And we'll get to it. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you, please?
Hey, David. It's Mike Listener. I was just listening to your pork conversation, had to jump in here. You guys have made some excellent points about, quote, pork and, quote, waste. And let me just offer that. It is a very subjective term. What is pork and what is waste? And I think you touched on that quite a bit in your discussion, is that bottom line is we got to understand senators and congressmen are there to represent their constituents. And their number one priority is to their constituents. The executive branch, on the other hand, has to be concerned with the whole smash, everything, the whole country. But that's what you have your representatives and senators to, and they are going to want programs that are going to benefit their constituent, their companies, their jobs in their state. That's what it's about. Now,
absolutely.
I see a lot of, you know, and I've basically sworn off the forums now. They just drive me so nuts. Basically, you know, people on the forums don't understand this. You know, well, if this is pork because it's not going, you know. Their definition of pork is spending it on a government program, but they're willing to throw it at a commercial company. So, in one case, what is pork to them is putting it into a government program, but it's not pork if the government gives money to a private company like Orbital or SpaceX or something like that. So, the term pork is extremely subjective.
Can I let me share with you sort of my personal definition of pork. I don't sort of fall into the commercial versus government sort of thing. I mean, Lunar Cost is a public-private program. It is, you know, it's both working together. I'm fine with, for example, Mars being primarily a government program because I think that's where the best fit is. But to me, the way I view pork is basically ask the question is, if we were to spend this money in a different way, could we achieve more with the same amount of money? In other words, can we be more cost-effective? Can we get more bang for our taxpayer dollar? And so I don't care if the government has a more cost-effective way. Hey, that's fine with me. I really don't care. Just so long as we can achieve more with the amount of budgets that we reasonably can expect. That's sort of my perspective on pork.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's a very good perspective. But right now we've become – space advocacy has become so polarized now. It's new space and old space. And old space is, you know, geriatric, they need to be retired, they have no place in space, and new space is it completely. And that polarization means any money that goes to, quote, old space is automatically pork. And it's really a completely false dichotomy in the way they're applying it. But again, space advocacy has become so polarized, and so, what is I can say? It's so much of a reality TV show right now that people really aren't thinking it through, and you know, and hence we're making bad guys out of these companies that, you know, like defense contractors that receive money for a space program versus a private company that doesn't receive the money for a space project.
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, I agree on the forums. There is sort of a knee jerk. Well, if it's so-called commercial, then it must be a good thing, when there's just so many problems with that. I mean, is it really commercial when the government is paying the majority of it? You know, the whole nine yards. There's issues there. What I would say is, even the definition of new space versus old space, I consider ULA, which is, I guess, presumably more of an old space company, in that they at least have their traditional space there. They've been there for many years and government contractors. Nonetheless, they're one of the more innovative companies, frankly, and they have, I think, technology which could significantly reduce the cost have been able to travel in cislunar space, and their whole distributed launch and everything. I mean, it's just really, I'm a big fan of ULA.
Yeah.
You know, but are they old space and therefore they're bad? I mean, it's just, that's just irrational, you know. It's like partisanship, you know.
But I think, Doug, what Rohrabacher's guy is saying in a roundabout, indirect way is what Casey is saying, and that is we can make going to Mars and we can make cislunar space and the moon happen, but we're building SLS to make that happen. And if there is no SLS, there's no political will to do these missions, even though there may be some engineering or technology or scientific reason to do it. But there's benefits to their constituents and around the country for the political side of this project, which, say, you and others in New Space don't like because you don't want to use SLS. So when he says to you, how do you, you know, how do you do this without requiring more money from the budget and making it part of the existing Mars budget, then he's really saying that this exists because of the political side of this. Now, how can you use these systems, tools, infrastructure to help pay for your system, or, you know, how do you balance it out? And so you're being asked to move the chess players around on the chessboard, but you're stuck with that chessboard. And I think that this is, you know, I'm always challenging you on what's, you know, phrase this in what's the benefit for the country. You know, you hear me say this to you all the time, and I say it, I've been saying it lately to Kim Holder, too, about her program on Moonwards and others. And I guess what I'm really saying is, to the benefit of the country is what Congress, is the political side of these missions that Congress sees as they're fulfilling their job and servicing, as Michael says, their constituents. So if you could say, well, you know, you're paying $3 billion for SLS, and let's cancel that and use the $3 billion this way, which also works for your constituents, but can, you know, make cislunar space a more viable part of this program, making the Mars program more viable, then they might listen to that, because you haven't changed the political side of why they want to do a mission. They want SLS because that helps them with their constituents. And if you're going to take that away from them, then give them something else that helps their constituents in a comparable manner that makes them want to use it for this mission.
Michael, is there anything in the Constitution or in law that says representatives have to bring back money for their constituents as opposed to working for the greater good of the country?
Not really. I can't think of anything right off the top of my head, and I don't think there's anything in the law either. It's just, this is the way things have always done. We are basically the same system of government as the Roman Empire was. We're a republic, which means we have, you know, we do have representative government. And, you know, back in Roman times, you know, the senators, the republic devolved into the senators, and, you know, the senators basically there for the benefit of their constituents. Well, for the benefit of themselves, too. I mean, let's be realistic about it. It's about power as well. But one of the ways, a pathway to power that the senators always saw back in Roman times was bringing home the bacon for their constituents. And making sure they were happy. So I'm not being overly cynical and saying that's where we are right now. But a senator's job is to make sure that their constituents are represented, and part of that representative is making sure federal funding gets back to their states.
So if a senator is able to look at the broader picture, like say for example, national security, foreign policy sorts of issues that affect the entire nation, irregardless of how that vote would affect the pocketbooks of people back in their state. If we can say senators can have that sort of perspective, why can't representatives have that perspective as well?
Well, I think they both do. Well, representatives, a lot of them do have that perspective. It's a balancing act. They understand they have a duty to the welfare of the nation as a whole, but they also have a duty to their constituents. Representatives are in a bit of a more sticky situation because they have 2-year election cycles versus 6 years for senators. We both know and communicated with one representative who is just a huge, very much in the space, Representative Bridenstine's office. I've had some excellent communications with his office, and he's really on it. But look at Oklahoma. Oklahoma doesn't have a lot of space infrastructure, but he is very much in favor of this space, impetus. But at the same time, he's got to remember he does represent the district of Oklahoma, and he's got to make sure his constituents' interests are balanced with the national needs as well. So it's a balancing act for these guys and women.
Yeah, so in this situation, I think, for example, the American Renaissance Act is not an Oklahoma-centric bill. So I think, David, let me say this about Robacher's staffer. There is another less cynical way of looking at this, that, you know, instead of saying you have to meet the, you know, you have to process the sausage to the people who demand it. Instead, he didn't have that emphasis. The emphasis that he did have is the same emphasis that I think Bridenstine and many others have had, and that is, we have a program of record. It is a program. And if we change directions with the next administration, there is concern that we're going to end up with not much at all in terms of America's space program. If we keep yanking, our direction, that we're going to lose what we have gained. And so that's sort of a less cynical sort of view of why he might, be supporting the program of record.
Well, I don't think that's substantially different from what we're talking about. It'd be great to get him to come on to the space show. I don't know how willing he'd be. I've never been able to get a member of Congress or their staff to appear as a guest on the space show. But it would be terrific. I do know a high-ranking person in Rohrabacher's office who has been on the space show when he worked at the Space Frontier Foundation. And I don't know, maybe if you can give me an introduction to the guy after the show, I'll invite him, and I'll go to my member of my friend over there in Rohrabacher's office and ask him. It is election time. They're probably really, really busy, and I don't know if they would see appearing on the space show as being risky for Rohrabacher's re-election. He's coming out of Orange County, which is pretty conservative, so he may be secure. I don't know anything about his challenges or anything like that.
Yeah.
Well, my interjection would be, during election season, forget it. I mean, especially if they're up for re-election, it would be very prudent of them to get as little exposure to things, as controversial and as probably not as popular as space, and get cornered into slipping up and making a comment that their opponent could come back and use against them.
Well, no, but I don't even have any dates available before November
8th. Yeah.
So, Doug, if you give me his contact information and his name, and if it's okay if I say I'm contacting you referred by Dr. Doug Plata, and I'll copy it to my friend in Rohrabacher's office, and I'll move heaven and earth to put the guy on the show.
I'd be glad to do that. Do recognize that of all of these, this is the most negative of my encounters. So I don't know if it'll be a positive thing for you.
I don't consider him being negative. I think he's probably maybe the most realistic of what it is going to take to, say, move your agenda into policy. And so I think he's being realistic, and he's saying to you, these are the facts on the ground. This is how they work. Now tell us why your program benefits
right.
our program of record.
Of record.
And if you
yeah.
can't do that, then obviously it's not going to be a program that Congress is going to buy. But if you can do that, and I agree with you, I'll work with you on it. So to me, he's putting it back on you to come back and
right.
enter their world which obviously you and I are not in. If we were, one of us might be elected or working for him.
And that's the way I came away from it. I mean, from the very beginning, I didn't really consider it to be just a crass political sort of sausage, you know, you got to give a sausage here. But rather, you know, he basically said, look, he said that on both sides of the aisles, it has come down to support for the program of record. So you need to show how your approach supports the program of record. That's what he said.
Well,
you know?
And so
I accepted that as, oh boy, yeah, I think he's probably right. And I got to rethink this because the value of the moon, including all of the political value of the moon, is apparently insufficient because of the commitment towards the program of record, the journey
right.
to Mars.
That's the element that Casey Dreyer described on the show that was startling to me because I hadn't heard it put that way. And I think this supports what Casey is saying, whether we like that or not.
Well, I would interject that this quote, journey to Mars, is basically a half-hearted thing. It really, Mars isn't a goal. It's basically it's something that's regurgitated every year politically, and NASA for the past 8 years has been flashing PowerPoints up at us, and you know, some pretty cool animations too. Until you have an executive branch saying, in their policy, in their national space policy, that it's our goal within such and such and such time, or we're making the manned mission to Mars a national priority or a national goal, I'm not going to believe it. Not until Congress actually, passes an authorization bill with one section saying mission to Mars, within such and such a date we expect a manned mission to Mars. They get around it by funding technologies versus funding an actual mission. So until I see until those two things, or hopefully both, I'm not going to buy into a manned mission to Mars. I'm not going to buy it.
Well, I agree with you, but you would have seen the manned mission to Mars, and I got to take a break, so this is going to be it on this topic. But if you had been at Space 2016 in Long Beach at AIAA, you would have seen all the evidence in color brochures and programming and meeting of NASA having a mission to Mars. So.
Yeah, well, you know what? I'm a lawyer, and I get paid to spin BS and also to ferret it out and look around it. So.
I mean, I got the full color four color printed brochure sitting on my desk as a memento of how we're going to Mars, and it was in full regalia at AIAA. But as you say, it is not by any means an official type of policy that has any real commitment for anything in it other than they're paying homage to a bunch of rhetoric and loose timelines. So
yep.
That's it. I got to take a break. Michael, you're welcome to hold on if you want more. Otherwise, I'll clear the line for someone else.
I think I pretty much said everything I need to say.
Real quick, your latest copy of Priestess was excellent. Thank you for sending it. And
Which one was that? The one I put out a couple weeks ago, the one I put out last week?
No, the one a couple of days ago. I guess it was last week.
Yeah. Yeah, that's thanks. That one was pretty intense, and I really let's put it this way: if a lot of people read it, they probably get pretty upset with me and disagree with my conclusions. But those are my conclusions.
Well, disagreeing with people is great. Nobody wants to have a clone out there where everything is yes, yes, yes all the time. So.
Well, yeah, that's true.
Okay, Michael, thank you for your call.
Good talking with you.
Okay, David. Yeah. Bye.
Listeners, Doug and I are going to take a break. We're going to be back in about 3 minutes. Please don't go anywhere. I've got emails waiting, and we will get to them when I get back. Stand by. Back in three.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. Part two of our Sunday program. Our guest is Doug Plata, and we have a couple of sponsors for this segment of our show. So Celestis is a sponsor. They're the global leader in providing Memorial spaceflight services since 1995. 12 people have walked on the moon. One person, planetary geologist Dr. Shoemaker, is buried there, known primarily for his discovery of Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 that dramatically impacted Jupiter in 1994. He has also played a key role in training the Apollo astronauts in the American Southwest, using Grand Canyon, Meteor Crater, and other Arizona locations resembling the lunar surface. He taught the astronauts about lunar formations and geological features, and they made the training very realistic, wearing spacesuits and tooling around in a lunar rover, taking soil samples. Shoemaker wanted to be an Apollo astronaut, but he had some health issues that prevented that from happening. So Celestis came to the rescue with his ashes. And with his friends, they included a symbolic portion of his remains on the NASA Lunar Prospector mission that impacted the lunar surface in July 1999. Fulfilling the dream of spaceflight is what Celestis is all about. And then the Integrated Space Plan is a sponsor as well, the highly detailed development chart showing the path of becoming a spacefaring race. See how technologies and destinations build on one another. Explore hundreds of individual elements in more detail at thespaceplan.com. You can join discussions. They have updates, ways to participate, and you can order your own poster of the space plan. It comes in one of two sizes. So check them out at their website, thespaceplan.com. And, Doug, I have three emails for you. This one was posted shortly before the show today on the blog, so any of you can go read it. It's by someone named Savu Poro, if I'm reading that correctly. I'm sure Dr. Plata is familiar with the unfunded Resource Prospector mission. Ground truth investigation of water at lunar poles is such a pivotal question, yet there seems to be no progress of actually getting this on NASA's exploration roadmap. Why? Any creative ways of solving this problem?
Yeah, I would totally agree that that program is one of the most vital such programs that we can have. I would be completely supportive of it. I think it's really critical. What I would say is I think the reason why it's not getting more support is because the program of record is Journey to Mars, and the moon has not been placed on the Journey to Mars. I'm not sure it should be. And so basically because of that, I think it's not a priority. And I think that's really bad and wrong. I think it should be a priority. However, having said that, what I'd say is if it turns out that the Lunar Resource Prospecting mission shows that the ice at the lunar poles is not really accessible, it's not practically accessible, then should we give up on returning to the moon? And I would say no. I think we should still return to the moon. The difference is that we would just have to launch both the descent and ascent propellant, and that simply increases the cost, but we'd still be able to support a lunar base. So I don't actually place ice harvesting on the critical path to the moon, even though I very strongly support seeing if we could develop it, because if we could, it would significantly decrease the cost of going to the moon and increase our capability of what we could do there and the speed at which we could do it there.
Okay. During our conversation with Michael Listener, John Hunt of Fort Worth sent in a note. So, again, we're going back to that waste in Congress kind of discussion. And he says, regarding Congress, whatever gets me elected isn't pork. So I guess that's from the perspective of the member of Congress. So that's his comment. And then Marshall sent in a note from the outskirts of Dallas, Texas, and Saxey, Texas. As technology changes over time, there has to be changes in our space missions. I find that NASA, when not in the lead, tends to be technology laggard or worse, naysayer. Is this a problem for Congress or the NASA bureaucrats or both?
Interesting. I would say that, and I sort of hate saying this, but my experience of interacting with the staffers, the space staffers, is that they are oftentimes interested in what the other staffers think. You know, what their views are. There's a bit of a group thing going on there, I think. And I wouldn't say that innovation is. I don't think we should look to Congress for innovation in coming up with progressive ideas how we can do things better, more effectively. They tend to be looking at the policies that are brought up and then make a decision on those things. So I think I wouldn't really look to Congress to provide the lead, albeit they play a critical role in setting the direction of the space policy.
Normally that comes from the president, but Congress has stepped into that because that didn't happen very well with the current administration.
Well, you know, because Congress are our representatives, then my hope would be is that if we, you know, the citizenry, if we have a good idea, I think the congressmen are the people who we should start with first. So I think there ought to be a pathway to be able to introduce good, you know, innovative ideas through the Congress. Let me just say about John Hunt. I really think that I think we should try to fight against cynicism against our government. I mean, my experience is that when I went to Congress and lobbied, in the first place, I was very pleased that here I am, a layperson. I'm not representing, you know, anybody. I'm representing my views. And here I'm able to get appointments, and they're very quick in replying to me. And I get appointments, and I'm getting significant amounts of their time, and they are listening closely to me. You know, they're taking notes and everything. So I sort of feel as though, and as I speak with them, I didn't come away with a dirty sort of like feeling that, oh, these guys are, you know, I don't know, money grubbing or asking, well, have you donated to our, to my representative? Nobody ever did that. I don't want to end up on the side of just assuming evil about people. You know, if there's evidence for it, then yeah. But my experience was pretty positive, and I feel like there's still, even at this age, we're still have access to our government, and our government seems to listen.
We do have the right to petition our government, and fortunately, that right has not been somehow usurped from us yet. We don't have the right for them to listen to us and to be honest with us. And I think the track record of Congress on so many issues that Americans don't want. I mean, Americans overwhelmingly did not want health care reform under the terms of Obamacare, and they had to change the rules of the Senate to allow it to be passed, and they paid no attention to what Americans wanted, and the damn thing is imploding. So I'm just saying there are reasons for so many Americans disliking the way Congress is being managed. That doesn't mean that they aren't happy that we can still have free speech and that we can petition our government. I'm really cynical about Congress, and on issues that I have petitioned the government about, I'm totally blown off, and typically I get replies back that have nothing to do with why I tried to petition the government in the first place. I can understand they may not agree with me, especially since, you know, I'm usually more conservative than California's legislature. But so I understand that, but I mean, that would be a whole different show on a whole different level, and it probably as a nonprofit, it's not a show I can do. But I'm very sympathetic to what you say, because it is incredible that we can petition our government on all sorts of issues. And I would urge anybody who has not done that with their state level legislatures or on the federal level, you should get off your butt and go do it, even if it just means going to the local office of your senator or your representative or your state elected representative. They all have local offices that you can get to. You don't have to go to Washington, D.C. to do it. But you should do it, and you should take advantage of this incredible right that we have through our Constitution to petition the government. That doesn't mean that when you look at the track record of these guys and gals, that it's something that one can be proud of or be optimistic about. And that is why, you know, something like 85% of Americans, depending on whatever day the poll is taken, think, you know, Congress kind of sucks. Anyway, you have another call, and I don't want to turn this into a political rant show, because that's not what we do on the Space Show, and everybody's welcome to their opinions, and their opinions are always respected, and there's no litmus test for being, you know, on the Space Show and how you think or what you think about. Let's see who's calling you. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you, and thank you for calling.
This is John of Fort Worth.
Speak of the devil. The cynical devil.
I thought I'd just throw a little political realism in.
Well, but you're from Texas. What the hell else do you expect, right?
But this whole discussion, in a lot of ways, harkens back to perhaps even to my very first call to the Space Show back in 2010, right after the Obama space policy was announced, and going forward to the debate with Rick Boozer that we had.
Oh, on SLS.
Yeah, because I remember the key point I was making in the issue of with Rick Boozer is that SLS Orion is the program of record. We have political support for it, and although there could be better ideas, maybe not, but the likelihood is if you kill this program, you simply have killed any major initiative for a long time, because there's nothing that has the kind of support to replace it, and that's harkens back to the first comment, which was I was saying, I'm fairly convinced that the administration that's in power right now basically was anti-moon, been there, done that, and what Congress has really tried to do is just save the basis of the space program for a future time period. I mean, essentially what we're building right now has less to do with Mars than what you'd really want, at least for a government program, to go back to the moon. The missing element is the lander. You know, I mean, if you had a moon lander and had to SLS Orion as it's fully planned to be, you have a moon program, basically. The Mars program is a lot of notional stuff, like we discussed at the AIAA, you know, there, which is kind of, you know, wannabe conceptual PowerPoint stuff, but it's nothing anybody's investing any significant money in.
So I sort of want to take issue with a bit of that, because I know a whole lot of people say that the journey to Mars is just sort of vaporware, it's just PowerPoint. And what I'd say is, if you had a very specific plan for going to Mars, what would you start with first? So you start with a heavy lift vehicle, and you start with the Orion capsule. I think you develop the transportation first, and you do stuff in space. And then you can afford to go ahead and build a lander, and maybe that's after you decommission the International Space Station. So, and people say, well, but there's, you know, what about specific missions? Are there specific missions that are identified? And my response is that, you know, if tomorrow Obama came out and says, okay, I've spoken to the NASA administrator, and here's my plan. It's really, 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 really detailed, okay? In my feeling, it's like, okay, now we have a plan, right? But guess what? It's going to cost as much as we imagined it would cost, and it's going to be as inefficient as we imagined it might cost. So to me, that's not really the solution for the problem. I think the solution is, how can we get more bang for our buck? How can we do this? I support
the SLS at this point in time from on this basis alone, and that is how many launches do you need of a heavy lift vehicle like SLS to be able to do a human mission to the surface of Mars? In my understanding, it could be anywhere, depending on who's you know, the DRA-5 or whatnot. It could be like 5 to 7 if you use like Boeing or to the DRA-5. If you need that many heavy lift vehicle launches for a single crewed mission to the surface of Mars, then it seems to me as though we need a heavy lift vehicle. Now, whether it's SLS or something else, I don't know, but it seems to me as with that, with our current approaches, that's what you need. And so I don't really have a problem with people saying we need it for any reasonable, you know, mission to Mars. The only problem I have is the SLS the most cost-effective way? And if the answer is yes, then let's stick with the SLS. If the answer is no, then what is the alternate way? And the sooner we get started down that path, I think the better.
Well, okay, but to assume we're going to have multiple launches of SLS on that level means that we're actually going to get the production of SLS vehicles up to something more of an economical rate than what's currently being done. What we're looking at right now is a prototyping effort, basically, and which obviously has a very high unit cost per launch. But it's not a viable program at this point. And if you did ramp it up and built them and, you know, on a regular production line basis, you could get your unit cost down significantly. But right now there's no money for that. You'd have to have a Mars program or a Moon program or some real program to afford to do that.
So, John,
yeah.
Let's presume that the SLS serves out its lifetime, and in 2024 it stops. Therefore, much of that money could be available to now, in that time frame, we're beginning to look at sending people to Mars, or is it the 2030s we're looking? I mean, first Mars orbit and the surface of Mars. But then couldn't you use that money that's now freed up, just like we have more money after the space shuttle's, you know, been freed up, after it's been, decommissioned. Wouldn't we say the same thing with the International Space Station, and then couldn't we afford the production of more SLSs?
Well, you're saying that we could, well, yeah, I mean, that's my point. SLS has become more efficient if you produce more of them. If you come down a learning curve and you have higher, amortize the fixed costs of the infrastructure and everything over a larger number of units. You're going to build one launch every several years. They're going to be incredibly expensive, and you can throw out the normal numbers people do about it, which is true, but it's a prototyping effort at this point.
But we're under the current budgetary profile that includes $3 billion going to ISS.
Yeah.
So when that changes, the cost of SLS changes because we're producing more per year.
Well, if they transfer the money from ISS to SLS, that would be true. Yeah, if they start producing them. Well, my point is, I don't think there's a viable alternate program right now that is going to have any real support, and that's why the people advocating space know that the best way to preserve the future in space, which is what I've been saying the whole time, is to continue with SLS Orion. I mean, we're almost at the end of this administration now, and depending on what the new administration is, and who knows what they're going to want to do, they would have an option to use what's been done during this time period rather than starting from scratch. I mean,
so my question is what about partially usable Falcon Heavy to low Earth orbit, followed by solar, you know, scaled up solar electric propulsion to an EML staging point? Then how much of a need do we have for SLS?
For Mars mission?
Yeah, in support of Mars mission, delivering cargo to an EML staging point.
Well, the other better way to ask that is, for your plan, why would Congress support that? What's the political component benefit for them to support what you just said?
Because we wouldn't have a Mars program teetering on running over budget because we found a cost-effective way of sustaining the program.
But they don't agree with your premise. You're not yet in their world of think. You got to enter their world of think, not your space advocate technology world of think. In order for you to communicate with them, they're not going to come into your world. You're going to have to go see what is of value and how they rate value. I mean, look, my Kool-Aid in fantasy is that this deserves extra money out of the budget because of the economic value of developing an off-Earth economy, which over time could enormously benefit the overall economy of the United States as well as other nations around the world. And we have proof of what happened with the Apollo program, for example. That is no more in Congress's think pattern than what you just said. And truthfully, I don't know how to put that in Congress's think pattern because of their political requirement. Because real economic sense doesn't really ride on having a political component, except the policies don't get implemented without the political component. And I think that what we're all missing, and that's just a cold, hard reality, as Michael said, of our form of government. And, yeah, maybe we can change it. Maybe we can improve it. I'm not against, you know, lobbying and making an effort to do that, but the playing field on the ground right now is how does your plan move into what they expect for programs that they approve to accomplish? And that's what's missing on my fantasy and what you just said. And I honestly, Doug, I wish I could tell you how to do it. I mean, I don't know how to do it, and I think that's probably led to a lot of my being more cynical than you are. Plus, I'm a lot older than you. And I think doesn't cynicism come with age? Isn't that a characteristic of entering geezerhood? I don't know.
There's a funny Dilbert comic strip in which he's explained to this young intern who thinks the world is all wonderful that, well, what should we do? You know, basically experience equals cynicism, so let's just beat it out of him and show him how cynical life really is so he can get past the experience real quick.
Well, you know, there may be some hidden truths there. I don't know.
John,
do you have anything else, John? Do you have anything else you want to contribute here that's positive? Be upbeat for a change.
Well, I just think I made my point. I think that what you're running into is just that, but I'm not sure. All I'm saying is that I sort of think the mission to Mars stuff has been a way to politically, it's a political compromise between the administration, who's really not big on human space and truth, although they like to take the image they are with a play of statement that was made by the president, but and on the other hand, you know, the reality of the Congress trying to support the programs they had in place, and so that's. But I don't really see much being done that would really be part of a mission to Mars in terms of money yet. If we tried to, if an ex administration, let's say, were to redirect to the moon, we haven't wasted hardly any money at all, really. And we would we'd be well on the way to building the infrastructure we need, right? What we need now is a lander.
I did have a guest on a couple of weeks ago, and I apologize, listeners, I don't remember which guest advocated this, but they were talking about making a Return to the Moon project an international component, and that an international ESA should do the lunar lander, and that would be their incentive to join in on a Return to the Moon program. Now, I don't remember the guest who was advocating that.
I think that's a very excellent idea, because that would let them have a component, and we've done, third, three-fourths of the effort or something with what we're doing. You know?
Yeah, is it the most cost-effective approach to that?
They don't care about that. And I asked him, that's probably not as cost-effective as having Mastin or somebody else do it.
Yeah.
And he said, if your choice is no mission at all or doing a mission with an international component and ESA building a lander that is more costly than what an American private company could do, but you have the return to the mission to the moon set in stone, what do you take? No mission or the mission set in stone that you don't like some aspects of it, but at least the mission goes? Those are your choices, Doug, unless you think that you can implement a third choice, which nobody is talking about, except space advocates.
But that's why, I mean, if the answer to the question, is this the most cost-effective approach, if the answer is no, then you know that there are more cost-effective
but
approaches.
But they're not going to get implemented, so you don't have a mission. So if your choice is to have a mission, and this is all hypothetical, by the way, because there is no international lunar mission going to the moon, as far as I know. But if your choice is no mission with the left hand and an international mission on the right hand with ESA building the lunar lander, even though we know that Maskin could build one cheaper, but the mission goes with the ESA lunar lander, and your choice is between left hand zero mission, right hand lunar mission, which do you take?
So the problem is you are forcing an exclusion.
Yes, of course.
Of the more cost effective.
But that's
so
how Congress is going to. But that's how Congress is going to approve.
Yeah, let me finish my sentence. So the question is, as a space advocate, do I give in to the political cynicism and say, even though there's a better approach that I believe is better, okay, but nobody's talking about it right now, should I just say, you know what? There's never in any future I can work with no representative, you know, to work on any bill, you know, what I was told by this Perlmutter's representative, hey, let's work together for a bill, you know, and work with the Office of Legislative Counsel, you know, should I say no, let me not pursue that path? I'm just going to say never will my policy ever come to reality. I don't know that that's the case. So I think I need to fight for what I think is the smartest way of moving forward.
Okay, so no place in alternative A and B, and I want to move on to your experiences at AIAA and the Mars Society. So, and at no time during my hypothetical left-hand option, right-hand option, did I suggest that you and millions of other advocates or Americans stop lobbying for better ways of doing that. I'm not suggesting that. What I'm suggesting is that you got an immediate option to go to the moon with the way the right hand is going to do it. It is not the best way, and in fact it can be used, if you're really bright and effective about it, as a teaching model of why option left hand, option right hand sucks for future ways of doing things. But at least you've got the lunar mission, you've got it underway, and now you have a teaching model to say, look, we could have done this differently. Why can't you incorporate that in your making a mission happen in Congress? Why do you have to keep doing it this way? So my hypothetical left-hand, right-hand doesn't preclude you from continuing to fight the good fight. In fact, if anything, it encourages you to fight the good fight because you see how crappy the way this system works to get a mission approved. But if the goal is to get to the moon, do you take the crappy way and keep fighting the good fight, or do you not go and you keep tilting at windmills?
So my response is I think that there is a plan A and plan B. In other words, the ideal plan, and then there's like the second best plan. And I guess I would just be concerned that if we head down to what I'll call an international space station on the moon, meaning an international thing that is as cost ineffective as the International Space Station has been, and then the countries get locked into a decades-long approach to lunar return, like we got locked into a decades-long approach to LEO, you know, station in LEO, I would be concerned that, you know, even though the better idea could have been done before, now that we're too far down this road, you know, we're just going to have to continue it. And I would say, okay, maybe that's a second best plan, but all along I'm going to fight for what I think is the most cost-effective approach that gives the most value for our taxpayer dollars that we're putting for space.
Well, I would fight the good fight constantly, too, but I'd go to the moon and use it as a teaching model to try to help improve the situation. Because
yeah,
we know that going to the moon on the international way with ESA, say, building a lander, we know it's going to be a lot more costly to fund the mission, and we know it's going to probably take longer because of, you know, international whatever. And we know that there's a cheaper way of doing it that Congress is not interested in. So let's codify all of this and then start lobbying Congress for, can't you guys do things in a better way, and here's a better way, and let's look at this. And you never stop fighting the good life, the good right. But you know, if you're going to tilt at windmills, you want to tilt with the most power possible, so you can maybe knock the damn thing over. Here, I really do want to hear from you about your Mars Society presentation experience and your AIAA experience. So, are you okay to move on? Because we're not going to solve Congress on this call.
Is John still with us or not?
He may have given up. John, are you still with us?
I'm in listening.
All right. Do you have anything else? Otherwise, I'll clear the line.
I'm going to get off and let you go on with the rest of your show.
Thank you very much, John.
Okay.
All right. Let's go to Mars Society first. You made some presentations at Mars Society.
Okay. Actually, we're sort of running out of time. I think there's a couple of emails. I feel like I need to mention about the Chinese document that I did in follow-up to these staffers.
Okay.
And then there's, Mars Society convention. So let me just mention that when I was there, it was like a couple days before the Space Science Subcommittee was going to be meeting on the topic of, are we losing our lead in space to China? Like, that was the title, pretty aggressive title. And so I knew that I was speaking to people and shortly before they're going to meet to discuss this. And even though sort of against my I had this voice in the back of my head saying, don't say it, Doug, don't say it. But in my conversations with people and as explaining what some of the reasons for going to the moon might be, I did make mention to almost all of them about, you know, if we don't put a return to the moon back on the agenda, there is a scenario in which China, you know, could be developed even now, I suppose, with their sort of hidden space program. Military space program, they could be developing a crewed lunar lander because they're not transparent. But at any rate, if we delay, there is actually a scenario in which if you head for the poles driving at Apollo 17 rover speeds, you could encircle the areas at the poles that have 70% or greater of sunlight throughout the lunar day. The more you develop it, like putting in roads as well as communication systems and sort of GPS type systems, and you sample, you know, prospect in that area, you could conceivably strengthen a claim to poles, sort of exclusive use, even if you didn't pull out of the Outer Space Treaty, but instead you're just saying, hey, we're working in this area, so anybody else needs to go to other parts of the moon. So I was a little hesitant because I know that sort of sounds somewhat conspiratorial and whatnot, and I didn't want to risk, you know, coming across looking like a kook, you know, some sort of space out of a kook. But I mentioned to people, the response was unclear how they were responding to it, favorable or not, it wasn't really clear. But what I did is after I left, within the next couple of days, I composed a document, a four-page document, sort of laid out what it was that I was talking about, and I was sitting there saying, boy, do I send this or not? You know, I'm thinking about how this would be perceived. But I bit the bullet and sent this document off to them and didn't really get a response. I got a response from one fella, Posey's representative, and the fascinating thing, he says, hey, would you like to suggest any questions that Representative Posey would ask of the guest when they come in and testify before the space subcommittee? And I'm thinking, goodness, here I am, a layperson representing myself, and I'm being asked by the space staffer to sort of put words into a representative's mouth during testimony. And I'm like, this is an incredible opportunity. So I fired out, I thought about it, boy, what should be asked? I fired off a question. And the representative or the staffer, he replied and said, oh, that's good. I'll include that in his list of questions. And then I watched it, and it turns out that he wasn't able to be there, I guess, at the meeting, and so it never was asked. But I thought I was fairly pleased that, again, a space staffer would, you know, pay so much attention that on his own initiative he would reach out to me and ask if I wanted to give input into what the representative would ask. I thought that was pretty positive.
So go to the Mars Society conference first.
Okay. So when I was in D.C., it was, you know, I went there for the Mars Society convention, and then I took a couple days. And actually, Thursday was the day when I had most of my meeting with the representatives, and yet Thursday was a full day for the Mars Society convention. So I missed much of the Mars Society convention because of my lobbying efforts. But as I look back on it, I would repeat that in a heartbeat, because I really think in terms of advancing my objectives as a space advocate, I think the lobbying was much better time spent than attending the Mars Society convention on that day. But on Friday, I had sent a couple of presentations, and both of them were accepted. And so I had back-to-back presentations on Friday afternoon. And so one of them was a presentation about inflatables, in particular my Unihab concept, which is a very large sort of pancake-shaped, sort of flat-roofed inflatable. And I actually brought with me the scale model that I had created. And I had an air pump. And so at the end of my presentation showing the benefits and some of the risks to inflatables, to make the point that inflatables are very easily set up, especially like compared with 3D printers, very fast, I had this demonstration on the table in the front of everybody and just turned it on. This thing unfolded and inflated, and there it was. You know, it went from a package to, the habitat, you know, without hardly any effort. And so that actually came across pretty well, and I got a lot of good feedback, actually some very practical feedback that I'm using to revise my concept. So that was good. And then a second presentation, it was, again, back-to-back, was this concept about para-terraforming. And just to let the listeners understand, terraforming is like where you're trying to convert Mars into have an environment like on the Earth, at least in terms of the atmospheric pressure and composition with enough oxygen. Para-terraforming is basically achieving the same thing sort of faster and quicker by basically, this is greenhouses. So you have your initial settlement, and then next to it you have sort of a large greenhouse area in which you can take Mars' existing atmosphere and you can remove the CO2 from it and add in some extra oxygen, and now you've created a high-quality indoor environment that has all of the air pressure and whatnot that you need. So you could have this large area that's a greenhouse, a lot of grass and trees and whatnot, even birds and whatnot. And then you can be in this environment without having to be in your spacesuit. So you have a type of sort of outdoor experience. And so I went through and showed how you could take in the Mars atmosphere and process it to make a more high-quality Earth-like environment. And again, I actually looked on the papers site for Mars Society Convention and found that in all of the years of presentations, there was no evidence that I could find that anybody had mentioned anything about para-terraforming. So I asked for a show of hands of how many people at Mars Society Convention were even aware of this concept of para-terraforming, and my estimate is only about 35% of them actually had even heard about it before my presentation. So that was sort of my goal, is to try to help get this approach on the table, get people aware of it. And at least for those people that attended, I felt like I had succeeded in that.
Okay, and about how many people were in the room when you were presenting?
Oh, I would say probably it was about 60 is my guess, something of that nature. So there was multiple tracks, so there were some people in other tracks, but the track that I was in was in the largest. And then I think the largest attendance that I saw was at the banquet on Saturday night, and that probably had about 300 people. So there was people sort of coming and going during the conference.
Did you get a lot of good questions and from the people in the room?
Yeah, I had about 5 minutes of questions each time. And they were good, respectful questions, I was fortunate. I felt like I was able to handle them. And I should mention, for any of the listeners, if you would like to see my presentations, the Mars Society has a recording of that. a little tricky as to exactly how to find it. It's not a simple YouTube searchable thing. I think they have it through the Mars Society website. If you go to the convention pages and look around, you'll find it, but they are not broken up into individual presentations. So mine is about maybe 70% of the way through the video before it finally gets to my presentations.
Of the one, is there a name for the video that yours is in?
There is, but I don't. I think it has something to do with Friday afternoon. I think that's in the title of the video.
All right.
Yeah, I might be able to track it down and then send that to you. Maybe it could be included. A link to that could be included.
Or you can post it on the blog.
Yeah, I can do that.
At your convenience. So tell us about AIAA then.
Yeah, so the AIAA week was sort of a very busy time for me, back-to-back conferences. So AIAA was the week before I went to Washington, D.C. And for me, this is the first time that I'd ever, in any field, that I'd ever written a scientific paper and presented it. And so that's the nature of AIAA. It's an academic organization, and they have different tracks with different presenters. And so mine was actually in conjunction with Jim Wirtz and Anthony Hsiao from Microcosm not Hawthorne, but near that area. And Torrance is where they're located now. And so the title of our paper, which was my idea, so I took the lead and I presented on it. It was about reducing mission cost by extending crew stay on the Moon and Mars. I specifically approached Jim Wirtz because he's sort of the guru for reducing mission cost. I think he's like written the book, literally. I met with him and what was at the time his graduate student at USC, and now is, his employee. Both of them have PhDs, so I was really looking for that because I felt like I needed help, from the real technical writing aspect of it. Basically we started out by saying that, there's many different ways to reduce mission cost, but for human missions to the Moon and Mars, there's sort of five that stand out. Extending crew stay by having adequate provisions, by ensuring your life support systems will function long enough as you extend your stay, so things like spare parts. Addressing the radiation issue, addressing the hypogravity issue, the reduced gravity issue, as well as the social issues, which was probably the most interesting and the most controversial part of our paper. So I think the pre-positioning supplies and keeping life support systems pretty straightforward. What we did in our paper is we had a diagram, sort of a nominal timeline of a mission to Mars, and showing how if you can extend crew stay so they don't return on the first return window but the second Earth return window, then not only do you have a significant savings by reducing launch cost because you're reducing the number of launches, but in addition to that, you are reducing the risk to crew because you have fewer of these high-risk events that are involved with crew rotation. And, of course, if you can prevent a catastrophe with loss of crew, then you could possibly prevent, reduce the likelihood that you're going to have a stand down in the program and the costs that are involved with that. We saw that with the shuttle program. Now, in terms of the radiation, we just dealt with it from a get enough mass on the around the crew in traveling to Mars, as well as mass on top of the habitats of regolith, to reduce the exposure. And did the calculations show how that would stay well within career limits, even for an extended mission. And the other thing is the indoor centrifuge. So it would also be in a shielded location. And so this is the idea. We can't really say for sure, that this will work. Because we haven't done the studies in space, but this is the idea of the gravitron, study that we did, experience that we did, doing sedentary activities for about 4 hours a day, 2 hours in the morning, 2 hours in the afternoon, and the experiences that we had. And that came across really quite well. I think people really enjoyed seeing that we, the authors, actually went so far as to actually ride in a theme park ride to be able to illustrate that sedentary activities are, in fact, possible. And then the most controversial part was the extending crew stay by making sure the crew can socially stay. So the crew, if the crew has dependent children at home, that would be problematic. If they had a spouse back at home for 3 to 5 years, that would also strain the relationship. And so we said that, and if you send a lot of singles, then singles in a confined environment working and living together could create some interesting complications conceivably. And so we said, whereas, you know, eventually there will be all sorts of people going to these destinations, that we felt that ideally probably having, like, couples that, you know, bring their spouse along and that don't have children could be sort of an ideal initial crew. And I didn't have a whole lot of time to answer questions, but the one question that was brought up was questioning this bit about, hey, you know, are you excluding singles, or, you know, exactly how would this work on the social side? So, yeah, that was the experience. And David, you were there in the room when I did my presentation.
That's right.
What was your perception?
I thought that people were really interested in what you were saying. I do agree with you that the social sort of got their attention more than some of the other things, and I think that's primarily because they don't typically hear social, but they hear the other issues all the time. So so this was like, you're hitting me with something new that they weren't that familiar with. And I don't think they have a good handle on how people will be mixed, you know, going. I don't think anyone has a good handle on that. But so saying, well, what about singles or married or this or that? I think they were really curious about that. And wanting to know who would be allowed or who would not to be allowed. I mean, a lot of people say take only older people because they're less susceptible to radiation damage, right? So how you socially match and set up a crew that's going to Mars, I don't know. By the way, I'm having dinner on October 30th with everyone's favorite space doctor, Dr. Bill Rowe. He is going to be out here, and he thinks women are the ones that should be going to Mars. Who's the African tribe that runs,
Maasai?
The Maasai, yeah. They should go because of their resistance to radiation and because of the high magnesium in their diets and the high altitude. So, but I don't know how many people are paying much attention. He doesn't have a format in the space community per se, but he does present at a lot of other types of conferences around the world. So I think people were definitely interested. I think it was very successful, and there ought to be a follow-up somehow for you to reach the same target market. Next year, Space 2017 has a new name to it, and it's going to be held in Orlando. So it's a little bit different, although I suspect the format will be the same. But I think people should hear about these issues more frequently, but not too many people are talking about them, especially in the environment of those that were attending Space 2016.
Let me just mention a few of the people that I met at AIAA. I got to meet Dr. Spoutis for the first time in person, and Tony Lavoie, or Lavoie.
They were in your session.
Yeah. I don't think they were there when I was presenting.
Yeah, I think I sat next to Paul when you were presenting.
Okay. Cool. John Spencer, he's sort of space tourism.
Right.
And so I actually drove to his home and saw his studio there and met his wife. That was cool. Joe Carroll, also, we had a good talk. Allison Zuniga from NASA Ames. So this is a very important meeting in which a Return to the Moon conference, whatnot, that we're having discussions about. And then I'd just like to mention Eric Franks. He's a friend of mine, met through the space show. And he works for Massive Space Systems. So Eric always listens to, I think, on archives. So just a little shout out to Eric there.
Right. And Eric invited people to a dinner that I wanted to go to. But unfortunately, I had my Lockheed interview set up for the same time. So I was not able to do it. The Lockheed interviews that all of you heard on those tapes from AIAA were set a couple of weeks in advance. But then I later got to meet Eric in person in the lobby of, what's the hotel there in Long Beach? The Hilton or whatever it was, that's connected to the Long Beach Center. And, it was late at night, so we just had some fun kind of frolicking types of things. I think you were there for part of that meeting too. In the lobby of the hotel that night.
Could be. You know, I shouldn't fail to mention, I did meet John of Fort Worth, so...
That's right.
Yeah,
and you also met Carrie, right? Our ballet dancer film festival lady. Didn't you get to meet
only,
Carrie?
Only very, very briefly,
But you did meet her, and I am going to be at the film festival. Did you decide to go?
No, I don't know enough about it.
Why don't you go? Go to Raw Science TV. RawScience.tv, I think, is the website. And you want to go to their film festival. It's Saturday, December 10th. And it's starting at like 1 o'clock in the afternoon until the evening. It's not very expensive to go to it. I'm going to be there with my son and his film partner. There's a lot of really well-known film people that are going to be there, plus the space people that are there. A lot of them you know, like John Spencer is coming, and quite a few others are going to be there.
Oh,
and
great.
It's going to be a hoot. And I'm going to stay with my son in Hollywood, so we'll probably, you know, drive over together, which is pretty far. I think it's in Century City, where the old Fox studio or theater used to be. So I think it's near, it's on Pico, West Pico, so you probably know the area better than me. But you ought to go, and... I think it'll be a really good time, and I'm really looking forward to going to it and to meeting the people and seeing some of the films, many of which are space themed. You know, it's more about science and technology. It's not 100% space, but a lot of the films are space, and a lot of the people are space people.
Yeah.
Go.
So, David, I'm cognizant that I think there's a couple of emails that we didn't get to.
No, we got to all of my emails. Since we got off of Congress, actually, here's another one for you that just came in. Since we got off of Congress, the emails have died down. I guess everybody wanted to thing in. So this is from Burton, who is in Montreal. Does Dr. Doug consider the impact of the forthcoming Blue Origin orbital launcher on cislunar activities? According to Jeff Bezos, the Falcon Heavy equivalent New Glenn is going to be the smallest Blue Origin orbital launcher. Also, does the combination of SpaceX's ITS and the Blue Origin's new Armstrong launcher will make the SLS a political liability, making the SLS supporters in Congress look like wastrels to the other Congress people not in space committees, presuming both the ITS and the new Armstrong come online. Finally, is Dr. Doug advocating a lunar research outpost like present-day Antarctic, or Antarctic bases, or something more? Thanks for taking my question. Should I reread that a little bit smoother now that I have practiced it, or do you?
No. I think we got the idea. We are running a little over time here, so let me just jump to it. I would say, just to answer the last one first, I advocate actually infrastructure first on the moon. So I actually think that companies participating in the lunar COTS programs, that it should be. Those people would be the very first people to arrive so that they can establish the infrastructure, the transportation infrastructure on which everything else follows. But then immediately after that, I would support an establishment of an international lunar research facility, and that would satisfy the investment that the government or governments made into it. And so these companies would continue to provide transportation for international astronauts to this facility, including NASA astronauts. And then these companies could, it would be an anchor business that these companies could refuel the landers from local resources so that astronauts from all sorts of countries, Brazil, you name it, Indonesia,
that they could have their own nationals doing essentially entire Apollo programs with each refueled lander doing suborbital hops to five or six different locations before returning to base to be refueled by those participating companies. So I think we can meet a large number of objectives by using this approach. In regards to the other launchers, so he mentions Blue Origin, we got Falcon Heavy coming up, and also ULA and their Vulcan. So all of these are very interesting, and I think all of them could definitely play a role in returning to the moon. A lot of them, we don't know a lot about them right now, but my experience, I sort of want to emphasize this, my experience in going to Congress and talking with people is I think my hope that a return to the moon program, I think that there are problems with when Obama said, well, we've been there, we've done that. There's, you know, our international partners want to go, we, you know, what country is going to have the first permanent off-Earth base, you know, foothold for humanity? You know, which country does that credit go to? There's some significant issues, and I was sort of hoping that with a new administration we could have a review of this. And I was also very cognizant that a couple days after I met with these people that Elon Musk was going to make his announcement down in Guadalajara. But my sense in speaking with the staffers, as well as the reaction to Elon's presentation. By reaction, I'm talking specifically, was there much discussion by anybody, the news media or anybody, about the SLS now that Elon had revealed his ITS system? And my sense is that the staffers, the message that I got was that there's not a strong, broad drive for return to the moon on the part of Congress. I'm not anticipating that. I think it would take work to be able to get that on the agenda. It's not a default sort of thing. And the second thing, my sense is that there was not question marks of, well, then what do we do with SLS if Elon is moving forward with the ITS? I haven't heard that discussion much at all. And so right now, I'm thinking it's more status quo, and we would probably need to wait 5 or so years before some of these other things start really impacting the question of the SLS.
Yeah, probably, but keep in mind they're bending metal on SLS right now, so it's way further along than anything Musk is doing.
That's right. That's right.
That doesn't mean it'll fly, but it's way further along. So you know, I had, who was my engineer on the other day? Gary Hudson was on the show the other day.
Mm-hmm.
And toward the end of the program, he was talking about the Exotic Propulsion Conference in Colorado that happened the week after AIAA. And one of the final questions was about his thoughts on what Musk said. And he used the word insane, so he said he thought it was insane. And he was asked, somebody asked him about the big rocket. And he thought it was absurd, and that we don't have any technological experience with anything 4 to 5 times the size of Saturn V. And he said that trying to tame or deal with the acoustic signature of a rocket that big would be a really challenging thing to have to try to handle in today's modern day engineering and technology. And then he spoke out against settlement on any place with a gravity well, instead supporting the O'Neillian concept of orbiting space stations at one G.
Well, I'm about halfway through listening to that on archives, and I haven't heard about any of that. So
it's at the very end, and it's only a 1-hour show. Gary had to cut and run, so you'll hear it at the end of the show. You will hear him say insane. I'm not making that one up.
I'm looking forward to it.
Doug, thank you very much for being with us.
Sure.
We appreciate it, and I hope to see you soon. If you decide to go to the film festival on December 10th, please let me know.
Okay.
And I look forward to saying hello to you down there and introducing you to son Michael and his friend Amanda. And we will stay in touch, as always.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. So we have a full Space Show week. So Eric Berger is with us tomorrow about his op-eds and editorials and stuff that he writes at Ars Technica. Never could figure out what the name of that is all about. But it's Ars Technica. Do you know, Doug?
I don't. Ars doesn't sound very good, though.
I guess it's a different language or something. But
yeah.
And then
Latin, probably.
And then Tuesday night we have a great show with. Did you meet Moriba Jha at AIAA?
No.
He is a University of Arizona professor, aerospace engineering PhD. On the behavior of space objects, and there is a whole department at U of A on the behavior of space objects. I've never heard of this before, but a listener referred him to me several months ago, and it's taken us quite a bit of time to finally connect on a date. I met him. He gave an overwhelmingly wild, successful talk at AIAA. People were talking about it at the reception. I guess the reception was Tuesday night. I went up and introduced myself to him, and that's probably what spearheaded him to finally pick a date to come on the show. Great guy, so I'm really looking forward to that. And then Friday and Sunday on the Space Show, as always. So it's a great week, listeners. Thank you for participating with Dr. Doug Plata. And everybody, stay dry if it's raining where you are, and have a great week, and keep looking up. Goodbye from Doug and the Space Show and myself.
Bye-bye.